at least some of the sides bounding the plantings. A couple of them had were adjacent to other commercial plantings of apples, and then at one site, the Ferber site, there was an abandoned orchard along the south edge. To give you an idea of the pheromone trap locations, here's a representative site, the Apple Acres site, and we had pheromone traps along the orchard edge, further in the mid-interior, and then further in toward the center. And you notice that at each of these strata, we actually have two traps, and we took the mean count for the data. And then we did this along all the remaining sides, so we end up with something resembling a sort of a cross transect. To sample the infestation of the larval infestations of terminals and fruit, we went back to these same sites and took our 500 count samples in each of them, so we ended up with a fairly thorough picture of what was going on throughout the plantings. Now I'll just show you some representative data from one of the sites, because in fact they were all fairly similar. The Apple Acres site here, and first of all, for the pheromone trap catches, although we took weekly readings of the pheromone traps, I pooled 2 week samples just for the purposes of this talk. So the first couple of weeks in June, as the first summer flight was beginning, and you can see the general trends here, going further into June and into July, where the peak flight of that first summer generation. The next couple of weeks as that first flight was subsiding, and then finally the two middle weeks in August corresponding to the second summer flight. And what I would point out is obviously there seems to be a trend of higher moth catches around the orchard edges, higher than in the center certainly, and the size of the circles correspond with general numbers of insects caught per trap. Now in contrast, then show you some of the infestation data for the foliage and fruit. The first couple weeks of July, you can see the infestation of terminals fairly uniform throughout the entire planting. The next 2 weeks, a little bit higher levels, but still about the same trend. And these 4 weeks of samples correspond with sampling for foliar infestation, so we looked at terminals, and what you're seeing here is percent terminals infested. Going into July and August, this is the damage to the developing fruits, and then finally the damage to the fruit at harvest as evaluated in September. And essentially what I would point out here is that unlike the pheromone trap catches, there is no real trend for aggregation of damage in any one spot, at least that we can tell so far. It's not entirely surprising that larval infestation should vary somewhat from what we see in the location of the male moths, but we were kind of hoping for a real clear-cut indication that there was maybe a trend for more damage on the edges or close to woods or along some compass point, but that didn't happen. Nonetheless, if it's true that fruit damage or larval damage of any sort tends to be relatively uniformly distributed any place in these rather large plantings, then it would serve as a good reason to be able to sample pretty much anywhere for damage in the farm in these rather large plantings to make as a basis for making management decisions. So it's not entirely all disappointing. Taking a look at all of the harvest damage of the fruit in all the sites across the three farms, you can see that the damage levels tend to predominate around the 1 to 2% level. There were two sites where on two of the farms the highest damage occurred on the edges adjacent to woods, but in the third site over here on the Ferber site, this same trend was not evident. Averaging all of the fruit damage across the farm, each of the farms, you see that we ended up with fairly low fruit damage in general, but you'll notice that it does still fall in that 1 to 3% range that I said is common. So just to give an assessment of what we've seen so far, Although large numbers of adults were caught in the traps all throughout all of the orchards, the subsequent larval infestations in the terminals and damage to the fruit remained quite low during the season in all the blocks. There were no substantial differences that we could tell among adult catches, larval infestation levels, or fruit damage in the different strata of the orchards. There was some indication of an edge effect in pheromone trap catches of males, but little evidence of distribution trends of any sort in the foliar infestation or the fruit damage. And I would just note that this is so far because we have yet to finish the analysis of these data. Our results suggest that a large-scale or whole farm approach to managing OBLR might reduce the damage from summer generation larvae more effectively than treating individual blocks or small plots, and in fact this would conform pretty well with what most commercial growers do anyway in making their management decisions. The results of our weekly monitoring sessions suggest that sampling the fruit might better determine the treatment need and initial timing than our traditional practice of timing preventive sprays for first egg hatch and then sampling terminals for larvae. And considering that the kind of damage done by this pest is somewhat more superficial than that done by internal feeding leps such as coddling moth and oriental fruit moth, we might actually be able to develop a fruit damage threshold for optimizing the economics of making management decisions for oblique banded leaf roller in our orchards. So I'd just like to acknowledge our grower cooperators, our tireless technical assistants for helping us go through all of these samples, and the cooperators in the crop protection sector for donation of pesticides and traps, as well as funding support from USDA. Thanks very much. Nope, I have Charles.
Is this a long-term experiment? How many years will you conduct such a...
Yeah, the question is how long will we do this, and I'm not sure. It depends on how strong we are. We might try it again, because we were actually a little bit disappointed we didn't have more pressure. I mean, it seemed to be a little bit less than normal this year, so we would have liked...
Size?
Possibly, yeah, that would be good, if the growers will have us. Yeah, I agree.
So it's not a criticism of what you do, it's just I'm interested in the long term stuff.
Yeah, we are also interested more in what would happen if we keep doing this. So I think 1 year's data is just 1 year, and you know, maybe next time we get a little bit more moth pressure, more larval pressure.
Thank you, Art.
I'll be talking about toxicity of essential oils to the oblique banded leaf roller, Crustonura rosaceana, and the rosy apple aphid, Dasaphis plantaginea. And then at the end, I'll discuss briefly the potential implications for using these oils as actual control methods for these pests. So, as we heard before, the oblique banded leaf roller is a serious apple pest, and the oblique and the rosy apple aphid, of course, is as well. And these are, in our area, they're probably the top two apple pests in the Pacific Northwest and southern British Columbia. But of course, as we heard, they're a problem in other areas as well, and I would say throughout North American apple orchards. One of the major issues that has happened is that we have a lot of resistance development, and in the case of the oblique banded leaf roller, part of the problem has been that we've also ended up seeing cross resistance between different pesticides. And I noticed that Mike is here as well, and Mike Smurl has actually done some work that's shown that azofosmethyl has allowed cross resistance to develop to the insect growth regulators, tebufenicide.
I'm going to talk about home insect control, a non-traditional topic for master gardeners, and I call it non-traditional because, as we have been, I think, generally talking about entomologists teaching master gardeners, it usually relates to insects and plants, and this is a program that is a little bit different. teaches specifically on household insects. And I know other states do this, so it's not unique or novel in a sense of the fashion, but it is something that is a little out of the ordinary, at least I think it is. So traditionally at Minnesota, household insects generally was not taught in our core course. We had a variety of other topics, and that's the way it was when I first started to teach it. Probably in the last about 5 or 6 years, I have added about a 45-minute to 60-minute segment on household insects, just enough so they can answer some of the more common, easier questions, but not enough for them to really, be too expert at this. And so it occurred to me that there would be some value to have kind of a specialized group of master gardeners who could answer these kind of questions in more detail. So I started to develop a program for this in 2002. Now at this time, we had another option for homeowners and other groups to have household insect questions answered, and that was a program called the Yard and Garden Clinic. It was on the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. It was housed by entomologists, horticulturists, and plant pathologists. We did phone calls, we did samples, and so homeowners could either go to master gardeners or could go to this clinic. Well, after I taught this for about a year and a half, this clinic closed. And so, to me, there was a little bit more urgency, or it became more important to teach this core group these questions, because there was no place on campus for people to direct these calls. If they called the entomology department, they would send them to the counties and ultimately to the master gardeners. So I put a program together. We did it as a series of evening classes, 3 hours. The first one I taught was four class periods, but I learned pretty quickly that was not enough time. So it's now taught as 5 3-hour evening classes. They get notes, but one of the centerpieces of what they receive is the NPCA field guide, and I do realize this has been just recently revised to the NPMA field guide, but it's something that the pest control industry uses quite a bit. It's lavishly illustrated. I think it makes a really nice reference for the master gardeners. I was not sure how many people would be interested in this because it was a somewhat non-traditional topic. But it turned out that there was kind of an overwhelming response. There were a lot of people who wanted to take this. And because my goal was not just to kind of stuff people in there, but to get people from as many different counties as possible, I actually restricted the numbers that came in from certain counties. So we ended up with 25 master gardeners from 12 different counties, which I thought was doing pretty good. So I had issued a survey, or administered a survey over the summer in preparation for this, asking a few questions. And the first question I asked was, what was your main reason for taking the home insect control class? And I kind of thought I knew the answer to this, but I thought I would ask it anyway. And of course, the first answer was to learn more about household indoor insects. And a lot of master gardeners responded in that fashion. But I was somewhat surprised by the fact that actually most really just wanted to learn more about insects. And master gardeners are you just can't teach them enough. They're always hungry for more information. So I thought that was pretty interesting. A couple wanted just any advanced class, and one person actually viewed this as kind of a review. You can see that these numbers don't add up exactly. There was about 10 people who answered both A and B. They were interested in indoor as well as just insects in general. So the three-hour class, this was divided up into two parts. The first part was lecture, PowerPoint presentations. We concentrated on identification, life cycle, injury, and then pest management. But what I thought was probably particularly useful was in the lab portion of it. So if we had the first part of the lecture was ants, then we had a lab on ants, and so on. And so I would give them specimens. They would not be marked. They would go through it. They would try and figure out, what it was. But then under these green pieces of paper was the answer, so they could, find out pretty quickly if they had the right specimen or not, or if they needed to look at it further. So these are the topics that we covered in the time. We included all the ants pest species, which was about 10, the vespid wasps, stored product beetles and moths. We did talk about cockroaches, flies, especially the small size flies, Termites and powder post beetles were destroying insects, although that's not as big of an issue in Minnesota. We do talk about bed bugs to a fairly great extent. And we actually, like in Texas, we talk about unknown bites, including delusory parasitosis. And we get into spiders, and then our last lecture is on nuisance invaders, which is actually a pretty big section. So, and actually, this lecture-lab combination is what we do the first four evenings. And then the last evening is actually dedicated to what I call the final lab. And I prepare 20 specimens with 20 pest management questions. No answers on this one. It's open book, open notes, but they have to go through it and try and figure things out. And I give them 2.5 hours to do this. Even after 2.5 hours, they're still biting and kicking to keep working on it, but I do have to kind of end it at some point. And then we go through the answers so they can, get the answers right away. And some are a little nervous to take this, or a little hesitant, but I try to reinforce to them that this is a practical exercise. It's not a test. And the idea being that if they can do this here in the lab with their peers, they hopefully will be, it'll be a little easier for them to go out the next day then and answer these questions from the public. So that's how the five evening classes would go. Now, like Texas, I administered a pre-test and a post-test, not quite as sophisticated as what you guys did, but about the first thing after I said hi to them on the first day, I gave them 10 multiple choice questions, which they, again, were a little nervous about, but I told them it's just a way of measuring what they would learn. And then after the final lab, we would administer a post-test. So 93 master gardeners, we didn't get this administered the first time I taught this, but after that we did. With the exception of two that did not score